You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
New York City's family court system is one of the busiest and overburdened in the nation, with roughly 11,000 cases a year and judges often carrying over 500 caseloads. ProPublica reporter Joaquin Sapien writes that the city's family court system seems perennially in a state of crisis, even as it delivers life-altering decisions to children and their parents. In his article, Dysfunction Disorder, Mr. Sapien investigated the work conducted by psychologists contracted by New York City's Child Welfare Agency and found that many of their evaluations were deeply flawed, affecting the lives of thousands of individuals. The piece appears on ProPublica.org, and I'm very pleased it has brought Joaquin Sapien to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Why do you describe New York City's family court system as perennially in a state of crisis? How far back do the problems go?
Well, as we note in the story, there's been some reform effort or another directed at the family courts for years. And if you talk to the people that work in it, they'll say that there's been some modest progress made in the last year or two, that the delays have been shortened. But for the most part, it takes an exceptionally long time for really crucial decisions to be made.
And delays were shortened because 9 new judges were hired in 2015?
That's part of it, and I think that they're beginning to install new systems to better organize the proceedings.
What kind of training do these judges have? Are they trained, or do they have backgrounds in mental health?
Well, having spoken to a number of them, they don't necessarily have any specific training in mental health. They're obviously attorneys. They have presided over many, many cases, often first in criminal court or civil court before they get assigned to the family court. A lot of the judges that I talked to were very upfront about the fact that it is enormously challenging work, in that there's often no right answer in terms of what to do with a family that is so troubled that it winds up in the family court. It's not the same as overseeing, for instance, a criminal trial where the prosecutor brings evidence, defense attorney defends their client against it. The judge decides on what's admissible and what's not, instructs the jury. Jury makes a decision. He does the sentencing. You know, some of these cases go on for years and years and years, and the judges are almost more like family counselors than they are what we might consider a conventional, jurist.
And you write that family court cases are often life-altering, and that in the last decade, 450 children have died while their families were known to the Administration for Children's Services, the city's child welfare agency. Were they under the court supervision?
Some of them very likely were. It's hard to say how many of them. But, you know, in order for ACS to kind of engage with a family, certainly there has to be some sense of court oversight, in order to make any kind of intervention. They've got to get permission from a judge. So there's no question that some of these families were certainly known to the courts. And ACS has come under a lot of scrutiny in the last year or so, given a string of deaths that outside oversight groups like the Department of Investigation and others have found could have been prevented had ACS taken, more substantive precautionary measures prior to the child's death.
A year ago, you interviewed a journalist, Abigail Kramer, who reported that there were, quote, absurd levels of dysfunction and delay in the speed of proceedings. Have those delays led to death or further abuse and neglect of children?
I think that that's almost certainly true. When it takes a long time to make a decision about whether a child ought to be removed from a dangerous home, you're increasing the likelihood that that child is going to come to harm. And so naturally, the chances that something bad's going to happen are going to go up if an intervention isn't made. Now,
but you note, on the other hand, that rushing through cases can lead to terrible decisions.
That's right. It's a difficult, it's an extraordinarily challenging task that we ask folks in this system to accomplish for us. On the one hand, we don't want to be overly reactive and remove children from families that are having some trouble, but where the parents have some capacity to be responsible. On the other hand, we don't want to leave children in homes that are clearly very, very dangerous. And, you know, just because we remove a child from the home doesn't necessarily mean they're going to develop into a well-functioning, high-functioning, successful adult. Conditions in many New York foster homes and foster homes throughout the country are, quite frankly, deplorable. So it's not necessarily going to do, it's not, there's no guarantees here that the simple act of removing the child from a home is going to ensure their safety or success.
Has the ACS always hired psychologists to evaluate the mothers, fathers, spouses, and children who pass through the system?
As I understand it, it's something that ACS came to rely on more and more in the late 80s and early 90s. And this is in part a result of, you know, genuine introspection on behalf of both the courts and social service agencies, recognizing that they didn't necessarily have the mental health expertise that a qualified psychologist or psychiatrist might. The allegation from a pretty wide variety of parties that we speak to in the story is that the courts have come to overly rely on some of these reports, and that the reports are more cursory than they should be. Psychologists are given a very limited amount of time with the families that come before them, and there's only so much you can say of substance in that limited time frame. And so by the time it gets to court, the attorneys are kind of picking and choosing what they want from the report to support whether they're advocating to remove the child or they're advocating on behalf of the parents to keep the child at home. In this particular case, what I've heard was that, you know, the reports that were produced for ACS typically were to advocate for removal. And because these are produced by people who are presumably quite qualified, who have PhDs, who have MDs, the judges rely on them and take them sort of at face value.
I'm speaking with Joaquin Sapien. His article, Dysfunction Disorder, is available on ProPublica.org. The medical consulting firm that you write about is Montego Medical Consulting. Why did the ACS contract with them? Weren't there city-run mental health clinics doing some of this work already?
There are city-run mental health clinics that are actually now taking more and more of this work on. They sought outside help in part because they believed the pitch from the person that ran Montego Medical Consulting for a long time, a very earnest guy named Jama Adams, who really believed in the value of these mental health assessments and thought that they could help ACS match distinct services to people with distinct needs.
Does he have a background in mental health?
He does. He's got his PhD in psychology. He had worked in for foster care agencies. He had, he'd been working in this field all his life. And there's no question, I think it shines through in this story, that he is incredibly dedicated to these folks. It doesn't necessarily mean, unfortunately, in the world of social services, that your end product is going to get you the result that you want. ACS put a lot of pressure on him to produce sort of as many reports as possible, as thorough as he could do them. But they weren't really willing to pay for the what's kind of considered the gold standard, or at least a standard that makes these reports meaningful.
And Adams told you the ACS wanted a champagne product for lemonade money.
That's correct. Yeah. He was full of sharp lines like that. He's a very insightful guy.
And he also said the belief that you can sit down with someone for an hour and get an in-depth psychological read on them is a myth. But that was the system? That's when the family showed up.
Right. So the organization struggled with no-shows. A lot of the time, the families who were ordered by a court or referred by ACS to come before a psychologist just wouldn't show. When they did show, Adams told me that they were given very limited background information on what exactly the issues were that brought them before the court, and that had a big impact on the quality of the reports. And with the limited amount of time that he had with these folks, he admits it was pretty difficult to produce anything of substance. Now, if you talk to the people who were defending parents against what were in these reports, they have a little bit of a different view. While they sympathize with Adams, they are very critical of the cursory nature of these reports, and they kind of had a front row seat in terms of what the impact of them was. And they saw families broken apart that should not have been based in large part on what was in these mental health evaluations.
What kinds of cases warranted a psychological evaluation?
So these particular cases are child protection. And so these are families that have been accused of neglect or abuse, primarily neglect. That's the other kind of important nuance for folks to understand, is that there's a little question that many of the families that come to, that get this far in the process, are profoundly troubled and often poverty stricken. Primarily Black and Latino. And, you know, that's part of the reason why the services that are offered to them are so poor. And so these are the kinds of cases that we're looking at. There's parents with substance abuse issues. There's parents with depression issues or more serious mental health issues than that. And there's parents that have all been alleged to have either neglected their child so severely that their safety is at risk, or to have physically abused their child.
So then they're sent for an evaluation that takes about an hour and is poorly paid for. Did we have the budget to get better services, psychological evaluation?
I mean, there's a lot of money in government. ACS isn't necessarily getting it. There's a lot of folks who would say that the money that ACS does have is misspent. You know, I think there was quite a bit of money that was authorized for ACS training and reform over the years. And yet we're still seeing a lot of the same problems that we'd seen before these budgets were increased. So, you know, is it possible? Yes. Is there a lack of, you know, either institutional or public will to increase services for these poor families? I think it's fair to say that the answer to that question is yes as well.
My guest is Joaquin Sapien. His article, Dysfunction Disorder, is available on ProPublica.org, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Joaquin Sapien. His article, Dysfunction Disorder, is available at ProPublica.org. Did the ACS have basic standards for evaluating parents, and was Montego following those guidelines?
There were standards that were outlined in the contracts. What happened was that there was a confidential study produced by, in part, the parent defender agencies, who went out and essentially hired a panel of experts to review these reports produced by both Montego and the mental health clinics in the courts themselves. And what that study found was that the reports did not meet basic minimum professional standards. And so as a result, judges were making decisions on deeply flawed evaluations. So while there may have been specifications in the contracts themselves, what came out of that contract did not meet what folks what the professional standards call for.
Did the city continue to work with Montego despite that?
They did.
This is 2012.
Yes. So they actually increased the amount of the contract to Montego not long after that report came out, and continued to work with them for another 2 years. And they gave them more money and referred more families to Montego in spite of this highly critical report.
Adams told you that most of the psychologists use the tick-off box to evaluate a patient's symptoms. What does that involve?
So that tick-off box is something that he referred to. It was the way in which ACS would communicate the basic background information of the family itself. And he was calling it a tick-off box to kind of get at the fact that it didn't tell you much about the person that he was evaluating. It would say something like, is the person depressed? Check this box if yes, if no.
Allow for a lot of nuance.
Does a person have substance issues, yes or no? His point in telling me that was to show how little the psychologist that he would go out to evaluate these families knew about the families before they arrived in their office.
Did the psychologist ever receive any feedback from the ACS about whether their reports or recommendations proved to be correct or incorrect?
Very, very little. And that's a big part of the problem with this system, is that after the evaluation is completed, the folks at Montego often didn't know what the result of the case was. And they didn't get much feedback from the judges or from ACS in terms of whether or not their reports were actually helpful.
At the beginning of your article, you describe a situation in which a young mother who'd been living in a Manhattan shelter for victims of domestic violence was in danger of losing her child. The interview lasted barely an hour. What conclusions did they draw about her?
Well, the evaluation used some language that a lot of people I talked to found pretty offensive and alarming. They called this young woman, quote unquote, primitive, and that she demonstrated irrational decision making, in part because of what she chose to feed her baby. This idea that any psychologist would call someone primitive, disturbed a lot of folks.
Was this simply because she came from Central America and had different ideas about what she might want to feed her kid?
Without getting too deep into the details, I think it's certainly possible that, you know, she was feeding the kid something that was kind of customary for people of her cultural background.
And what happened to the child?
So, as it turns out, that case is still in progress. So it's not entirely clear just yet, but there was a emergency order that was approved to temporarily at least remove that child.
You spoke to Emma Ketteringham of the Bronx Defenders. Didn't she instruct attorneys in her office to routinely object to evaluations from Montego?
She did, and a number of other parent defender agencies instructed their staffs to do the same. They found that the evaluations were so critical and so flawed that they so rarely reflected any strengths that the parent might have that they just, as a matter of course, told their lawyers to object to them. And that's part of the reason why judges gradually were alerted to the flaws in the reports, because so many of the attorneys and the defense bar were saying these are inappropriate.
And ProPublica also examined evaluations that were completed from 2009 to 2010, came up with an evaluation, said sweeping conclusions about parenting ability were based on single interviews. Weren't they doing things that psychologists hardly do anymore, like having a draw-a-person test and using Rorschach tests?
Yes. So one of the things that the Montego psychologists had practiced for a while were these tests called, quote-unquote, draw-a-person. And the idea is that you can make an assessment of someone's parenting ability or responsibility based on the way in which a person depicts their family by hand. Now, you know, I think that there can be, the argument is that there can be some value to those tests if they're presented with other data and they're presented, you know, they're backed up with more sort of substantial information on the person, but taken alone, there's really very little value. And in fact, they can be interpreted in ways that are extreme and even dangerous.
I thought that Rorschach tests are no longer even considered valid.
That, I think there's probably some psychologists that are still out there using them. I was surprised to see the Rorschach test in there. But I think that that kind of is a consequence of the limited amount of time and oversight of the psychologists that were doing this work, that things like this were still being used.
I'm speaking with Joaquin Sapien. His article, Dysfunction Disorder, can be found on ProPublica.org. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Was Adam surprised when he learned about the results of the independent review of Montego and the city clinics in 2012?
You know, that was one of the interesting developments in the reporting, is that he really wasn't that surprised. He felt that the standards that study held him to were too high. In his view, these were meant to be snapshots. These were meant to be pretty, you know, superficial in a way, reports. And the standards that he was held to were for things that would have taken, he said, weeks or cost thousands of dollars, where, you know, he had hours and was being paid hundreds of dollars.
But Christine Gottlieb, the co-director of the NYU Family Defense Clinic, argues that Adam's acknowledgement that the evaluations were meant to be screenings and not in-depth forensic analysis doesn't absolve Montego of any responsibility. She says they're not off the hook. Why?
That's correct. I mean, in her view, and I think that, you know, there's it's a perfectly valid argument. In her view, that Montego should have been more upfront about the limitations of these reports. And if it turned out that they were deliberately shallow, they should not have been presented as though they were more substantive than they really were. And Adams, I think, would say that he tried to be more upfront with ACS about the limits of what he could do with the money they were willing to pay and the amount of time they were willing to give him with these reports. Whether all of that nuance was disclosed in a proceeding that can take, you know, 20 minutes and is one of 500 cases that a judge has to look at is another question. So, you know, there's a lot of different actors here that share responsibility for the system as a whole being tragically broken.
And what about the judges? How much responsibility do they have to rely on more than evaluations when they're deciding the fate of a child and a family?
That's a great point. Now, ultimately, it's their call. And this is what we pay them to do, is to make sense of these evaluations and to discern whether or not they are appropriately produced and whether they meet scientific standards. The reality is they don't have a lot of time to do that. As you said at the top of the program, some of these judges carry caseloads of, you know, 500 some odd cases. And the lawyers that represent these folks are equally overburdened. And so it can be difficult for them to take the time to do an appropriate, thorough cross-examination of an expert or of their evaluation in court.
You spoke to David B. Sachs, who served as a judge on the appellate court for 19 years. What did he say about the use of evaluators?
He was blunt. He said that he had seen, you know, some CYA, the acronym for cover your ass, by judges who went and, you know, sought out experts who would sort of come up with findings that might support their judgment of the case.
And Christine Gottlieb said that in other civil cases, expert reports like the evaluations would be extensively litigated before they could be used as evidence. Why doesn't that happen in family court where, well, I'm also curious about how often it means the breakup of a family.
The evidentiary practices are different. And so, you know, these reports can be introduced at a much earlier stage than what might happen in a criminal court. Whereas, you know, in a criminal matter or a civil matter, you have the opportunity to have discovery, to take some time to examine the report, to argue about it in court. Whereas some of these reports were done on the fly when the family appeared in court to support an emergency order. And so the evaluations were done very quickly, and the proceedings subsequently were done very, very quickly.
And Gottlieb said the bottom line is they just would not be this would not just be happening if these were families of privilege and power.
That's right. I mean, I think that that's the case for a lot of what you can say.
So we're talking
for
about
social services.
Issues of race, class, being serious factors in determining whether a family is kept together or not.
Yeah, and since you brought up the contrast, you know, if you look at matrimonial court, for instance, or if you look at custody cases where it's two wealthy parents who are battling for custody over their child, there can be an evaluation that's done in those cases as well. And those evaluations take far more time. They cost far more money. And there's still questions about whether or not they're actually valuable, because it's more like sometimes both parents will go out and hire their own expert to produce a report that is friendlier to their side. However, the standard is a little bit higher.
The results of the 2012 review of Montego was shared among family court judges and city officials that year, but it was kept secret. Why?
They had agreed to collaborate on making improvements, and that was a big part of why they decided not to release the study to the press. They also felt that, you know, it was possible that they needed to continue to do more expert work before they did it. But because the report was so well received by the mental health clinics and the family courts, and there was this agreement that all sides would work together to make improvements, they decided, let's avoid any kind of negative publicity. ACS, however, did not make that same agreement. They did not agree to approach this issue collaboratively. They said, we're going to handle this on our own. We'll launch our own investigation of Montego's work. And of course, shortly after that, they wound up redoubling the contract.
But then eventually dropping Montego. Does Montego still exist?
No, their work has, for the most part, ground to a halt. They do the occasional evaluation for foster care agencies, but they're doing very little work for ACS. And that,
so somebody else is doing it?
Yes. So there's a few other contractors that had already been doing work for ACS who now might be taking on some of these mental health evaluations. But we're going to be looking closely at the quality of their work as well.
And what is your sense of the final evaluation? Do they usually suggest that the child be taken away?
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't actually put it in terms that are that strong. But certainly the sense from the parent defender agencies is that they very rarely represented that the parents had any strengths at all, which they found just to be deeply, deeply unfair.
2 years ago, Mayor de Blasio authorized a $26.4 million initiative to improve training and supervision at the ACS. Is there any evidence that more money will solve the agency's problems?
I think, in part, it's about how that money is spent. It's a big, troubled bureaucracy, has been for quite some time. You know, just this past weekend, they were in the headlines again for the death of another child that was known to the agency. Gladys Carillon, who took over the agency some time ago, was very well received early in her tenure, was viewed as a real champion for reform, and she's just resigned tearfully and with a lot of regret. So there's a lot of open questions about whether improvements will ever come to ACS.
Joaquin Sapien's article, Dysfunction Disorder, is available on ProPublica.org, and we have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.